Muslims in Iran and several other countries celebrate Eid al-Fitr. That marks the end of the fasting month of Ramadan. Saudi prince slams the U.S. for failing to tackle what he calls security threats to the region. And Germany says sanctions imposed on Russia over the war in Ukraine will not be lifted until Moscow reaches a peace agreement with Kyiv. Thanks for joining us. Muslims in several countries celebrate Eid al-Fitr, a major Islamic feast that marks the end of the holy fasting month of Ramadan. Iranians have marked the auspicious occasion with worshippers attending Eid al-Fitr prayers nationwide. Iraq, India, and Pakistan have also commemorated the event. Other Muslim nations observe the Eid on Sunday and on Monday. The timing of the occasion can differ in various countries. That depends on the sighting of the new moon, which marks the beginning of the month of Shawwal on the lunar calendar. Eid al-Fitr is an official holiday in all Muslim countries.
The fasting month of Ramadan is over, and Muslims have ushered in the second most important festivity in Islam, Eid al-Fitr, or the Festival of Breakfast. Muslims start their Eid al-Fitr by taking part in congregational prayers themed with bidding farewell to Ramadan and welcoming the Eid.
Eid al-Fitr is a celebration of our months-long endeavor to connect with God more closely than other times of the year by enduring the hardship of fasting. I'm so happy to be able to fast, and Eid al-Fitr is my reward.
I am so happy to mark Eid al-Fitr, but at the same time I miss the spiritual atmosphere of Ramadan. It's a month when you feel closer to God than ever.
After they complete the Eid al-Fitr prayer, Muslims then visit their relatives and loved ones during the festivity. It's the first time in 2 years that Muslims have marked Eid al-Fitr without COVID curbs, so they can celebrate Eid al-Fitr together.
Over the past 2 years, we were not able to visit the elderly and other relatives. Thanks God, the coronavirus has subsided, and we can celebrate Eid al-Fitr with the people we love.
Every year on Eid al-Fitr, Muslims set aside a portion of their annual income, dubbed fitriya, to donate it to the poor. They say this is to spread the happy mood of Eid al-Fitr among the needy.
Zakat al-Fitr is a very small portion of our income, but it makes a significant difference when all affording Muslims join in. This way, the rich and the poor share the festive mood of Eid al-Fitr.
Eid al-Fitr falls on the first day of the lunar month of Shawwal. According to the Islamic lunar calendar, months begin and end depending on the movement of the moon in its orbit around the Earth. And the start of each month depends on the sighting of the new moon the day before. Iran sighted the Eid al-Fitr crescent on the eve of Tuesday, while many other Muslim nations announced the festivity on Sunday and Monday.
Eid al-Fitr is a culmination of 1 month of abstinence from eating and drinking. And that's why Muslims consider it a divine reward for their success in obeying God's order. This year, the festive mood is multiplied as Muslims can celebrate it together without the worries of the pandemic. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Family of an Iranian national on trial in Sweden for alleged rights abuses has told Press TV about his dire situation. They say that Hamid Nouri, a retired employee of the Iranian judiciary, was humiliated, beaten, and denied access to medical services. Swedish prosecutors have requested life imprisonment for Nouri over allegations of human rights violations against members of the anti-Iran terror group Mojahedin Khal back in the 80s. His family says his arrest was illegal. They accuse the Swedish judicial system of issuing an arrest warrant for him without an independent investigation and based on untrue claims by some people. Nouri's wife laments that Swedish officials did not allow them to even meet him for nearly 2 years after his arrest. On Sunday, Iran's foreign ministry summoned the Swedish ambassador to protest the detention and the trial of Nouri. The ministry said it considers Nouri's detention illegal and based on propaganda by the anti-Iran terror group MKO. The ministry rejected allegations against Nouri as baseless, describing his trial as political show. The MKO is responsible for killing some 12,000 Iranian people and officials in the 1980s. Including the country's then president and prime minister. The military wing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas claims responsibility for the retaliatory operation conducted on Friday in an Israeli settlement in the occupied West Bank. Ezzedine Al-Ghassan Brigades says the operation was a response to the regime's aggressions against Al-Aqsa Mosque and Palestinian worshippers. The group said that it takes pride in this operation, which was carried out by its fighters. Hamas's military wing added that its forces are fighting along with other resistance forces across the occupied territories. Ezzedine Al-Ghassan Brigades warned that the Friday operation will not be the last of its kind. On Friday, an Israeli guard was killed in Ariel settlement situated near the city of Nablus. Early the same day, Israeli forces had attacked Al-Aqsa Mosque in the occupied East Al-Quds, leaving at least 42 fasting Palestinians injured. Israel has escalated its aggressions against Muslims' third holiest site in recent weeks. An Israeli rights group says the regime is holding around 600 Palestinians in administrative detention, holding them without charge or trial. Hamokit Group says the number is the highest since 2016. It says administrative detainees are arrested on what it calls secret evidence. The group says those detainees are unaware of the accusations against them and are denied the right to defend themselves in court. The so-called administrative detention allows the Israeli regime to indefinitely keep Palestinians behind bars. The practice has drawn widespread international criticism, including from the UN, calling for an end to it over violating the rights of prisoners. In the past years, Palestinian administrative detainees have, on various occasions, held hunger strikes to protest their jail conditions. The senior Saudi prince criticizes the U.S. in tackling what he calls security threats to the kingdom and the region by Yemen's Ansarullah movement. Prince Turki Al-Faisal said Saudi Arabia felt let down at a time it thought both sides would jointly face the danger. He was referring to Yemeni missile and drone attacks. The former Saudi spy chief also cited a U.S. decision to end its support for Saudi-led offensive in Yemen. He went on to list U.S. President Joe Biden's refusal last year to meet Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and his move to temporarily withdraw anti-missile systems from the kingdom. Relations between Riyadh and Washington remain tense over a number of issues, including the brutal murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Turkey. The U.S. is also angry as Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have resisted calls to help tame oil prices amid the Russia-Ukraine war. Another instance of Quran burning has erupted in Sweden as a notorious racist activist from Denmark continues his Quran burning tour of Sweden. Fears are high of a return to the 4 days of violence which saw furious Muslims vent their anger at authorities over the Easter weekend burnings. Rob Carter is in Stockholm and brings us the latest.
Quran burnings have once again returned to Sweden as far-right Danish activist Rasmus Paludan desecrated the holy book outside Stockholm's central masjid on Sunday. Later that same day, he travelled to Uppsala and attempted to burn another, but local Muslims chase him off, one nearly being run over in the process. Paludan is a notorious leader of a far-right political party which stood in the last Danish elections, receiving just 1.8% of the vote, failing to win a seat. In 2020, he was jailed for racism and other offences. Throughout the month of Ramadan, Paludan has toured Sweden, burning Qurans in several Muslim-majority areas in various cities, sparking 4 days of violent unrest over the Easter weekend. Local Swedish opposition Nuance Party condemned the authorities for allowing the burnings.
Well, actually, in Sweden, you're not allowed to say or do whatever you want. So this concept of freedom of speech is already has its rules and its regulations. For example, 3 years ago, a neo-Nazi party burnt the Pride flag, the flag that the LGBT movement uses. And for that, they were charged for hate speech or hate against a certain people. Nowadays, the politicians, they don't account Muslims into these kind of minorities. On one hand, they're defending other minorities and their rights to be left alone or to not be hated against. And on the other hand, they are defending people who are hating it towards or against Muslims.
There's no word to describe the our disappointment to the other political parties and the public figures that are defending him. We don't see any political parties that are going out and defending the Muslims and that are talking about issues that facing Muslims. So I think that is why this is happening.
Peace and tranquility has returned to Sweden, but tensions remain high as both local Muslims and the Swedish authorities know that the Quran burners will be back. Paludan has made absolutely clear that he intends to run in the Swedish elections this September, and it's very likely that he will bring further unrest back with him. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
The German Chancellor Olaf Scholz says sanctions imposed on Russia over the Ukraine war will not be lifted until Moscow reaches a peace agreement with Kyiv. Scholz said that Russia is mistaken if it thinks that it can gain territory from Ukraine and then stop the war. The German Chancellor said the Russian President Vladimir Putin underestimated the resistance of Ukraine. Scholz added that Putin did not think the West would support Ukraine to the current extent. He said it is for Ukraine to determine the terms of any peace agreement. Scholz also rejected criticism over Germany's delayed military aid to Ukraine. Scholz is under pressure at home and abroad to supply Ukraine with heavy arms and support EU sanctions on Russia's energy imports. Daily requests for Russian gas deliveries to Europe through Ukraine have hit a five-month high despite tensions over the war in Ukraine. That's according to data from a transmission system operator in Slovakia. The data shows even the Russian gas to Germany via the Nord Stream 1 showed an increase on Monday. Meanwhile, EU energy ministers held an emergency meeting to discuss the Russian threat of halting natural gas exports unless European countries make their payments in rubles. Moscow has already cut off supplies to Bulgaria and Poland due to their refusal to pay in rubles. This, as a Hungarian official says, at least 10 EU countries are already buying Russian gas with rubles. The EU Commission, however, says that it is not aware of any company agreeing to comply with the Russian demand.
We don't have any information that this is true. On the contrary, right now, the Commission doesn't have information about any country or private company who is willing to do so.
The EU official also dismissed the option of paying for Russia's gas in rubles through a conversion scheme managed by Moscow. She called it a breach of the bloc sanctions, which is not acceptable. She made the remarks during the EU energy ministerial meeting in Brussels. The European Commission is expected to propose a sixth package of sanctions against Russia over its war with Ukraine later this week. The package will include a ban on Russian oil imports. Germany says it is ready to support the embargo, but has warned that such a move would require a lot of preparations. The European Union imports 40% of its natural gas and 26% of its crude oil from Russia. A senior U.S. official says Russia plans to, quote, annex the two eastern regions of Ukraine after failing to overthrow the Kyiv government. U.S. Ambassador to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe said that Russia plans to engineer referenda in the Donetsk and Luhansk regions sometime in mid-May. Michael Carpenter said highly credible reports indicate that Russia is considering a similar plan in Ukraine's Kherson region, which is now under its control. He said such, quote, sham referenda and attempts to annex additional Ukrainian territory will not be considered legitimate. In addition to Donetsk and Luhansk regions, the U.S. and its allies consider Russia's annexation of the Crimean Peninsula following a 2014 referendum illegal. U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has paid an unannounced visit to Kyiv in the latest show of support for Ukraine and its fight against Russia by a senior Western politician. The U.S. and its allies have supplied significant quantities of arms to Kyiv and imposed economic sanctions on Russia. But such approaches were not only unhelpful to put an end to the war, but also proved to just add fuel to the fire.
Leading a congressional delegation, U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has paid a visit to Ukraine, Pelosi, who is the highest-ranking American leader to visit Ukraine since the start of the war, has reiterated Washington's support for Ukraine. During a meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, she vowed that the U.S. would stand by Ukraine until the end of the war with Russia.
We believe that we are visiting you to say thank you for your fight for freedom, that we are on a frontier of freedom, and that your fight is a fight for everyone. And so our commitment is to be there for you until the fight is done.
The United States is in an explicit war to weaken Russia and to defeat Russia, to help Ukrainian government defeat Russia in Ukraine. And it's, you know, Zelensky is really is someone who isn't making the decisions here. He's not going to be allowed to make a deal unless the United States lets him, and unless the right-wing forces in Ukraine let him.
Zelensky, for his part, thanked the U.S. and its Congress for, in his own words, the powerful signal of support. Pelosi's visit comes as the U.S. and its allies are stepping up to provide long-term support to Ukraine as the fighting rages on. Later in a statement, Pelosi said Russian President Vladimir Putin's, quote, diabolic invasion had taken a devastating human toll on Ukrainians. She also pledged imminent additional American support for Ukraine. The U.S. has already committed $4.3 billion to Kyiv in military support since 2021. Now, in a major increase of such funding, U.S. President Joe Biden has called on Congress to provide another $33 billion in emergency funding for Ukraine, including $20 billion for military aid. Moscow has warned that the aid would only fuel the conflict. Also, last week, responding to pleas from Zelensky, a group of 40 nations gathered by the U.S. and Germany agreed to streamline and expedite the delivery of weapons to Ukraine. Western nations have imposed broad economic sanctions on Russia and have been shipping increasing quantities of weapons to confront Russian forces. The Western intervention could lead to Russia's military response and raise the risk of confrontation between Russia and NATO, as well as a nuclear conflict. Some experts believe Washington's war aims had broadened from helping Ukraine to defend itself to damaging Russia itself. This notion supports the Russian narrative that Moscow's actions in Ukraine are to defend itself against NATO.
And that is it for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
اللهم أهل الكبرياء والعظمة وأهل الجود والجبروت وأهل العفو والرحمة وأهل التقوى والمغفرة أسألك بحق هذا اليوم الذي جعلته للمسلمين عيدا ولمحمد صلى الله عليه وآله زخرا وشرفا وكرامة
We here at IRIB English Radio congratulate the Islamic Ummah and all world Muslims on the blessed occasion of the Eid al-Fitr. A joyous Eid al-Fitr to you all.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد میشید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, you heard on Imam Khomeini's struggles against the despotic regime of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, especially his opposition to the so-called White Revolution, which was a plan to legitimize the Shah rule. This time, we are going to dwell upon the events which led to the Imam's arrest in 1963. As you know, we have tried to quote from Imam Khomeini's venerated wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, who was truly a fellow combatant beside the Imam. Stay with us, please. Imam Khomeini's opposition to the ceremonial referendum of the Shah awakened political groups and they accompanied the Imam in the struggles. But the regime announced that the referendum was successful and most of the people voted for it. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, at the threshold of the Iranian calendar year 1342, corresponding with March 1963, announced a public mourning. The Imam said, I announce this feast, Nowruz, as mourning for the Muslim community in order to make Muslims aware of the dangers ahead of the Quran and the country. The Imam had smartly announced that Nowruz as mourning day, not due to the martyrdom of Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, the 16th infallible successor of the Prophet of Islam, but rather for the conspiracy of colonialists against Islam and the Quran. He said in a speech on the last day of Isfand 1342, corresponding with 1963, this year we have no feast, and I announce this feast as a public mourning, not because of coincidence with the martyrdom of Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, who has a lofty status, but due to the disasters and losses that have been inflicted on Islam. This year was not a happy year for Muslims. In this year, colonialism schemed plots against Islam. The wicked agents of colonialism insulted the Quran. They designed plans to violate the luminous laws of the Quran. They designed schemes and have plots in mind. If Muslims know what plots and designs are underway against the dignity of Islam, the happiness of Muslim nations and independence of Islamic countries, they will never mark feast. The announcement of public mourning by Imam Khomeini moved the entire Iranian nation. On the 2nd of Farvardin, the agents of Shah regime intended to disturb the ceremony held at Imam Khomeini's home on the occasion of Imam Sadiq's martyrdom, but they failed. Then, the security agents of the regime assaulted Faizia school in Qom and massacred many seminary students and mourners of Imam Sadiq to cause fear among the public, particularly ulema. However, Imam Khomeini called on people to be resistant and help the injured. The news of the bloody events soon spread to the whole country, and preachers took stances against the brutal regime. Nearly 2 months later, the atmosphere of the country was zealous and inspired by Imam Hussein's epic as Ashura was approaching. Imam Khomeini called on preachers and ulema to expose the Shah's servility to the U.S. and Israel and the dangers of this puppet regime for Islam and Muslims. Thus, people in Tehran held demonstrations in Tehran on the day of Ashura, and many of them and the near cities went to Qom to hear the Imam's speech. On that day, Imam Khomeini delivered his historical speech in which he directly addressed the Shah. He said, "Oh, Mr. Shah, I advise you to give up these acts. You are being fooled. I don't like to see everyone giving thanks on the day that you are leaving the country. Do not play this much with the nation. Do not be this much opposed to ulema. Take admonition from your father. Listen to the ulema of religion as they like good for you. By God, Israel has no use for you." The speech of Imam Khomeini against the Shah horrified the regime, and on the following day, some of preachers and people attending the speech were arrested. At midnight, the Imam's house was assaulted and he was arrested. Imam Khomeini's wife relates, "These events continued from the beginning of Muharram till Ashura, leading to that speech. And the next night they came and Ruhollah Khomeini was arrested. The Imam had got up for midnight prayer. From the noise, he understood that what was going. It was 2:30 at midnight. The Imam came to me and said, 'They have come to take me. Don't be upset and make no noise. Awaken others and tell them to be calm.' He was speaking so calmly that he insinuated calm in me. He was telling these words while I could hear the fast and worried gasps of the dastards behind the door of the house. They seemed to be 300 to 400, but there were more on the main street. There, they changed the Imam's car and transferred him from a Volkswagen to a Mercedes. The Imam, seeing the street full of agents, told the one beside him, 'So many people have come to take one?'" Imam Khomeini's wife continues on the night that the Imam was arrested by the agents of the regime. "The sound of gasps became faster. The Imam left me to put on clothes. I was worried, but I awakened the children calmly, telling them that the strangers wanted to enter the house. Everyone woke up, but no one said anything. Everyone was listening to me. Suddenly, the door of our house was open with a kick, and there was a row. I called on everyone to be quiet and didn't let anybody defy the orders as the Imam had asked so. The Imam's shout disturbed the calm in the house as he said, 'What's up? Why are you making so much noise? Our neighbors are asleep. Do not disturb them.' At that moment, the door was broken and they poured into the house. They asked the Imam's whereabouts, and he pointed to his chest, saying with a sneer, 'He is here,' and said, 'I am Khomeini. Do not bother anyone.' The children wanted to shout, but I prevented them. The commander of the enemy asked, 'Is it you?' The Imam said, 'Yes, it is me. What do you want at this time of night?' Three people said in panic, 'Please let us go.' And they took the Imam. Mustafa asked the agents to take him too, but the Imam told him seriously, 'Go back. Whom are you pleading?' After arresting Imam Khomeini, his family was sad, but his wife changed the climate. She says, 'It was getting clear little by little. Our home, the home whose members had lost their father, source of emulation and leader, was interesting. Everyone was sitting stunned in a corner. Suddenly I said, 'Stand up. It is the time of prayer.' And that morning we performed a nice prayer." Imam Khomeini's wife continues, The imam would relate that on the way, he told them that he wanted to pray, but they didn't let. He told them, "Stop for a few minutes so that we pray together and then we move." They didn't permit. Upon my insistence, they just stopped and I stooped and touched the soil and performed tayammum. And I was forced to say my prayer in the car. Then, as I caught the sight of oil reserves of Qom, I said, "All or many of the miseries of this country stem from oil." They were so much impressed that one of them said, "Sir, we will return you. We know that we are guilty, but returning is equal to being shot dead." He was not saying these words for flattery, but he was rather speaking sincerely as he wept.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to European countries stating that they will cut off their purchase of Russian oil and gas, that has not come to fruition. There are at least 10 countries that have continued to not only purchase their energy needs from Russia, but have also complied with the Russian demand that it be paid in rubles, even though the EU has banned member countries from doing so. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how the EU, led by the U.S., is willing to sacrifice its economy and its people in order to sanction Russia with no real substitute strategy in place. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Harley Schlanger, spokesman for La Ruche organization, joins us from Potsdam, Germany. Also joining us, Paola Raffone, Secretary General at SIPPI Foundation, who joins us from Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Harley Schlanger, let me first start with you. Let's first look at the Russian demand for rubles. It's going great, according to what we're seeing. Russia's ruble, the currency, is the most profitable currency, as it's been reported, for the month of March. And, of course, this comes after the U.S. said that it's just going to tank, and people said the ruble is going to turn into rubble. What do you attribute that to?
Well, there are two basic points. The first is that the Russian ruble is backed by something real, unlike the dollar, the pound, the euro, which are backed by printing presses. The ruble is backed by the physical economy of Russia. For one, Russia has a lot of gold. but they also produce wheat, they produce strategic metals, they produce timber. And so when countries trade in rubles, they are getting something that has some intrinsic value beyond just the paper money. At this point, the dollar, the only value of the dollar is the insistence of the U.S. that it's backing up the dollar by the United States economy, which is actually the economy that's tanking. So on the one hand, the Russian ruble is relatively stable. As you pointed out, it's back at its pre-war level after it had really gone down for a while. And it was a very clever move by President Putin to protect the Russian economy, to demand that the gas payments and oil payments be made in rubles.
Okay, let's take a look at the stance of the EU, the European Commission. Paolo Raffone has made a statement saying that it has no information that any European company has paid in rubles for Russian gas. Do you find that a bit odd that they would have no information when there are at least 10 European countries who have continued their purchases?
Well, officially, no country has acknowledged that they paid in ruble. Probably it is happening, but behind the curtains. And this is because of the enormous pressure that the United States has put on the European authorities that did not authorize any of the member states to do so. So what will happen, I cannot predict, but I may say that there is a certain difficulty among the member states because of the impact that sanctions are having on the already weakened economic perspective. So if we go on like this by the summer, it would be really economically catastrophic. And the winter to come will be socially unmanageable. So that's why probably behind closed doors and behind the curtains, something is happening that cannot be acknowledged.
So behind closed doors, our guest there, Harley Schlanger, says that the purchases are being made. And from what I understood from Paolo Raffone, it is the U.S. that's pressuring the EU countries. What is it that the U.S. is doing to pressure these countries that they have to come out? I'm not going to use the word lie, but they have to come out and paraphrase, maybe, or say an alternate explanation. What type of pressure is the U.S. exerting on them, if you agree with our guests there from Brussels?
Well, first of all, one thing that I can confirm is that there are 10 European companies, which are in the gas, oil and gas business, which have opened accounts at the Gazprom Bank. Now, this is the demand that the Russians made. The way that you can do the trading is that you deposit dollars or euros or pounds in an account in the Gazprom Bank, and then they'll put rubles in an account that you also are holding there that can then be used to pay for oil and gas. So there are companies that have already done that, although haven't been named. Now, the pressure from the United States is enormous. And we saw that just last weekend with the meeting in Ramstein Air Base, where the German government, which up until April 22nd had insisted there would be no weapon shipments to Ukraine, suddenly reversed themselves. There's enormous pressure coming from the United States. On Germany, the Germans were told, if you don't go along with us, you'll be labeled an unreliable partner. And I think smaller countries are very much afraid that they'll be targeted for economic problems from the International Monetary Fund, from the banks. Many of these countries are facing payment crises coming up, and that's the leverage that the international banks out of London and Wall Street are holding over their heads.
So when you talk about that kind of pressure, are we talking about the fact that countries that may do business with Russia, even though they go the route of, for example, Gazprom Bank is where, I guess, the euros or dollars have to be deposited, turned into rubles, and then the purchase is made, that if they do that, that they're going to get pressured and maybe sanctioned because they're trying to make sure that their economy is going well, that it's sustainable, and that people are not starving or that they don't have to pay these enormous gas bills, that they're going to get penalized for that? This will be for Paolo Raffone.
Yeah, sure. want to avoid that people take the streets, although already on the 1st of May we have seen a certain animosity in some of the streets across Europe. Things cannot go but worse if we do not stop this spiral of war in which Europe has nothing to do. Basically, we have been put into this war, which is technically taking place on European soil, but in fact is a war between the American perspective on the future of Europe and Eurasia and the Russian perspective on the same. So Europe is in between, and it has been summoned by the traditional ally, which is the United States, to follow suit in a war which is against Russia, which is practically a stupid move, because if something we should avoid is to have an enemy on our soil, which is Russia. So I see a very bleak future if we do not stop the war and we do not stop the sanctions, and we give a chance to peace, which means dialogue and find a solution, not arming people to defend themselves. This is not a way to calm the situation, and there will be no winner for a long time. So we risk to have a prolonged war, at different stages of warfare, but with no solution. And meanwhile, our economies will suffer, and people too.
When you take a look at the statements, Harley Schlanger, that's coming out from the EU, is something that I want to point out and then get your reaction on, which are the inconsistencies in what they are saying. And not just on one occasion, two occasion, or three occasions, on more than that. For example, right before this emergency meeting that the EU ministers had, you had two European Union diplomats who said the bloc is leaning toward a ban on imports of Russian oil by the end of the year. Then you have a statement coming from the EU commissioner that said, well, if you do go ahead in a warning to the countries that are going to go ahead with purchasing Russian gas through that dual system, as they called it, I believe, that they will be breaking the sanctions. What is the EU position here? I mean, are we to believe that the EU actually is forthright in wanting to stop their ultimate goal, stop purchasing Russian gas and oil? Or are they just saying that, as you said, to see if some time can go by, perhaps there'll be some kind of solution to the conflict?
Well, it's very difficult to see that the EU has an actual goal. The European Union, in my view, is very dysfunctional. The goal is the goal of the British and the Americans to weaken Russia, as Defense Secretary Austin said at the Rammstein meeting, as Biden said. Biden basically said the goal is regime change. So the bigger issue here is whatever happens in Europe on oil and gas is not the concern of the United States or the British. They don't care if the populations in Europe suffer from a shortage of electricity, which is going to happen. They don't care if their own people suffer, because gas prices in the United States are rising through the roof. Their goal is to destroy Russia, and there's a reason for it. The Russian ruble policy is part of a bigger policy, which is the beginning of a shift away from the petrodollar system. And the February 4th agreements between Russia and China signaled a willingness of these two countries to stop the blackmail that comes from the International Monetary Fund and Wall Street and the City of London. And there's support for Russia and China from many of the formerly non-aligned nations, former colonial nations who know how bad the European colonizers are. And so the problem is the Europeans are sort of collateral damage, just as the Ukrainian people are. The Ukrainian people are being used as a battering ram against Russia.
Well, Paolo Raffone, but isn't the U.S. shooting itself in the foot when it comes to the dollar? I mean, one of the biggest mistakes, as was said by a Citi monetary financial advisor, he said that the day that the U.S. and its partners confiscated Russian currency and deposits overseas, that was the alarm bell that went off, for example, for China, that they have their money overseas and they have reserves also in dollars, that they're going to start dumping the dollar. And, of course, you, as you're well aware, this is going to set off these dollars that are going to come back to the U.S., and then perhaps the U.S. is going to be headed into hyperinflation. So in that respect, more importantly, the dollar is being risked. Is the U.S. willing to take that risk, which it seems like it is?
Well, this is a common practice of the United States. I mean, this is not the first time that they've been seizing national assets, but until when they were doing it for small countries or islands or, you know, inoffensive groups of enemies, it was feasible. This time they've been touching one of the five members of the Security Council. By the way, is the second or the first nuclear power in the world. And this changes completely the effect of what they have done, because evidently this is a breach of the Washington consensus, because Washington consensus is grounded on the trust that you have in the rules that govern the world currency, which is the dollar. But if those rules are then breached, and you decide to take away the assets of another country just because you esteem that it is your enemy, well, then the role of the dollar is into question. And we already see some reactions in China. They would like to avoid a currency war to the dollar, because the dollar in itself technically is working well as a currency. The thing is that it is managed by a state that is evil.
If it's doing well, then why is it that Israel is getting rid of some of its dollars? That has come out and said last week it's a liability. Why is Saudi Arabia doing the same and both opting for the yuan?
Sure, they do that because if you had your huge assets deposited in dollars anywhere in the world, the United States government can come and take them from overnight because they decided you're an enemy country for whatever reason they have.
Right.
And
okay.
This is not something that is a rule. It's arbitrary.
Let's move through the EU countries. Number one powerhouse, economic powerhouse, Germany. Harley Schlanger, I said I'm going to talk about inconsistencies. And here is one that goes flat or right in the face of the EU, coming from the German, I believe, Minister of Economy, Vice Chancellor and Economy Minister Robert Habeck. Whether an overall oil embargo is about to happen, I don't know. I'm hearing different things, and I'm talking to my colleagues about different things. Other countries are not there yet, and I believe that should be respected. What do you think?
Well, first of all, Habeck is a completely immoral character. He's a leader of the Green Party. He's shutting down nuclear plants. He's shutting down coal plants, and he wants Germany to stop buying any oil and gas from Russia. And that's because of his green ideology. Now, German industry is saying that if Habeck's policy is carried out, then the German auto sector will collapse. There'll be 1.5 to 2 million jobs lost. The machine tool sector will collapse. This is one of the great strengths of Germany, the intersection between machine tools and new technologies. So what Habeck is doing is playing a very dangerous game. But I think, just to take one step back for a moment, the sanction policy, you mentioned before hypocrisy, the sanction policy itself is a hypocrisy. The idea that the West supposedly supports sovereignty and democracy, and yet if a country doesn't go along with it, they get crushed with sanctions under the so-called rules-based order. That's the hypocrisy there, and we see it in Germany in a big way. And there is a reaction developing in sections of the population, especially unionists, peace movement, the so-called left party, the Linke Party, the so-called right party, the AfD. The real threat is that the Social Democrats, which used to be the peace party in Germany, has been completely submitted to the tyranny of the Greens and the Free Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we see the German situation heading toward over the cliff.
I'm not too sure where to start. I mean, I think it was actually Harley Schlanger in one previous program that you said that there are people in Germany that perhaps can't heat themselves because of the rise of energy costs. We have inflation that even the U.S. had a contraction that it reported -1.2% for its GDP contraction, which many are saying is going to perhaps lead to a recession. You have cooking oil that's being rationed in the UK. The IMF has come out and issued a stern warning for the African continent, that parts of it is going to probably have civil unrest because of lack of food. And I could keep going on and on. Of course, petrol and energy prices causing inflation in many countries. At what cost is this coming? I mean, is this a global conflict at this point, what we're looking at?
Yes, I would say that the conflict is occasionally taking place in Europe in a country called Ukraine, but in fact it's a global conflict. It is a conflict that has been boiling down for quite a while. I mean, it's not something that started in February 2022. This is something that roots back, I would say, to the 70s. And then with different moments, it has popped out. But especially, we can say that it has been very, very visible in 2001, 2008, and now in 2022. So it's all linked. And the fact is that the hegemony that has been imposed by the United States in this multilateral, what they call the multilateral governance of the world, but in fact it's unilateral, masked by multilateral, this is no more sustainable. And they have to come to terms with themselves to accept that the world is larger, is much more complex than it was 50 years ago. And they have to open up in a sharing mood. But until when the United States doesn't make this process, we will face, all of us, a very, very worrying time with a lot of catastrophic consequences.
The rewards for Russia, Harley Schlanger, based on the report that has come out, is that it's going to have more income. It's going to rise sharply this year based on this report, $180 billion, despite the production cuts that have happened, and saying that one of the major attributes behind that is the rising oil prices, which will be 45% higher than last year. My question to you is, it doesn't seem like there's going to be a stop to the purchases made for Russian oil and gas. So isn't that a losing cause that the U.S. is leading and the EU supposedly is following, which it's really not, to say that they're going to try to suffocate Russia, at least in terms of its income?
Well, the whole thing is a losing cause. The problem that Europeans face is that the potential for trade with Russia is enormous, also with China, and they're cutting this off in order to support an intention of American and British bankers to sustain a collapsing financial system. And so the Europeans are essentially buying a sick horse here and trying to ride it, and it's not going to take them very far. You know, I think the deeper question here is that if you look at what Germany just did in terms of reversing its policy on arms shipments to Ukraine, it shows that Germany is still an occupied country for all intents and purposes. Its policies come from London and Wall Street. The foreign minister, Baerbock, basically is reading a script from Tony Blinken and from Liz Truss, the British foreign secretary. There's no independence in Europe. The Europeans are somewhat trapped in this fake illusion of a European Union, which is certainly what they might call a rules-based order, but rules that make no sense for the individual countries. And what I see is that the pressure on Russia is going to force more countries to pull back from trade with Europe. You see it already with countries like Nigeria, South Africa, Brazil are talking with Russia and China. India is doing a special transaction system to have the ruble and the rupee transferable. The Chinese or the Saudis are accepting the yuan for payment in oil. So we're moving to a new financial system. I don't think the dollar system is dead yet, because the dollar system still plays a role and the Chinese would not want to see it disappear. But they're not going to give up their sovereignty for the sake of being in the good graces with Washington and London.
Thank you for that, Harley Schlanger, spokesman at La Ruche Organization, Potsdam, Germany. Paolo Raffone, Secretary General of the SIPPI Foundation from Brussels. Thank you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitakli, it's goodbye until next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio This is your host Musa Al-Bahadili and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing In this program you will discuss issues, relevant questions and other fields regarding the Islamic upbringing of children And we would like to stress that the answers that we provide in this program are all based upon the narrations of the household of the Prophet and, of course, of the Prophet himself and upon the Holy Quran, supplemented with scientific research. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend, Sheikh Ali Himani, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for joining us.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's my pleasure to be here in your studio.
So last time, dear Sheikh, we spoke about these outrageous fashion trends we may see and notice in our teenage children. Now I would like to talk about how we can treat and cure this very weird phenomena in our children.
Correct. Many things are available to handle the scenario, but one of the most important and the primary one that I would say is to keep them occupied. The more they are occupied, the less they have time to think about different things, what they look like, what they're wearing, the color of the shoes, is it matching with their pants, is it matching with their t-shirts. Because it's a free mind. If you don't keep them occupied, you don't give them activities, they have free time to think about. And when they have free time, they spend all this time on themselves. Let me give you my example. When I finished my O-levels and A-levels and I was getting into my university, I was doing multiple courses at a time. I was doing my bachelor's in commerce. I was also going to another institute to learn information technology and programming. And with that, I was also doing the course which is popularly known as chartered accountancy or, you know, the GPA course, you call that in UK, where it gives you the civil and the corporate laws about how to run a business, how to establish a business. And so I kept myself occupied and I had no time to look at myself and think that, oh, does this hairstyle look good or should I go for another hairstyle? Does this kind of a shirt look good on me? Should I opt for another tighter, shorter shirt? So on and so forth. So parents should know. And they should also observe the children and see what are they interested in and give them those kind of activities. Activities which are related to, you know, physical roles like mowing the lawn or taking out the garbage or helping them build some furniture at home.
Right. But Sheikh, wouldn't you say it is a good thing that they care about their appearance?
One part is to look at yourself, keep yourself neat, tidy, and
presentable
and composed. And the other thing is overindulgence. Now, what we see among the teens today is overindulgence. You know, the more concerned about their looks rather than their financial stability. I have seen and heard of teenagers who spend $3,000 on just their, you know, purse, their bags, $3,000 on the shades, on the glasses, sunglasses, right?
So you're talking about the extreme cases, because
not just necessarily extreme cases like this, where, you know, they're spending thousands of dollars just for their, you know,